In this part of Focus 580, we will talk about preserving early sound recordings. And our guests here in the studio are Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy. And they are the owners of Archaeophone Records, located in St. Joe, Illinois, not very far from here where we are in Urbana. And they're interested in preserving and annotating public domain recordings of the acoustic era music and entertainment industry. And if you're not quite sure what that means, well, we'll talk about that. What the recording technology was before we got to electric microphones, the kind of things that we use now. They have brought some examples. We'll play some music and we'll talk a little bit about what is involved in finding these recordings and processing them with contemporary technology to get them to sound as good as they possibly can. And, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both very much.
Thanks for having us.
For being here. Obviously, here, one of the things that you're doing is you're taking music that that exists, but maybe it's hard to find. It's in form that people aren't easily going to be able to listen to now, maybe wouldn't sound real great just because of the limitations of the technology and the condition of the discs or whatever it is that it's recorded on. So it definitely is a way of making this kind of material accessible to people who as long as you've got a CD player, you can play it and listen to it.
That's right. We're using discs, 78s.
Oh, hold on a second. For some reason, we seem I'm not getting their mics in my headphones there, Henry. How about now?
How's that?
Okay, there we go. Yeah, I'm sorry. There are some bugs in the technology. We have, you know, it's only 2004, but we haven't quite got that worked out. Yes,
that's right. Each of our compact discs is a collection of usually 20, 24, 26 songs taken from original sources. In our case, that would be 78 RPM discs, so-called 78. They sometimes went faster, sometimes went slower, and wax and celluloid cylinders. Many of your listeners probably know all about 78s. They've got some of those stashed away in the closet still. But maybe they don't know about cylinders. These are what they sound like, cylinders. They look like, you know, maybe toilet tissue rolls, a little bit thicker. Made on wax. In the earliest days, it was a brown, malleable, soft wax that was recorded directly onto in the days before mass production, so they'd have to make them one at a time. And in later days, they managed to get a molding process where they could mass produce them, and these were done on celluloid.
Did you start out here just because this was a particular interest of yours, that is, you were interested in really old records?
Well, we started collecting, and at some point we realized that none of this was being reissued and it was being lost, so we thought we should try and preserve some of it. Because in a lot of cases, before mass production, there's just a few copies around, so if you don't have the copy, you don't know of the record.
That's right. It's the interest in documenting this stuff, in preserving the history, in getting these public domain recordings out there and educating people about America's musical past.
Yeah. Well, I thought maybe we should definitely play some music, and it might be a good thing, or at least I thought, of the CDs that you sent over for us to listen to, that we could start with what is the oldest thing on here. This is the Edison Concert Band from 1897, and so I'm assuming this was an Edison cylinder?
Yeah, this would be a brown wax cylinder from about 1897.
All right, well, let's hear this. This is the El Capitan March.
El Capitan March, played by the Edison Concert Band. Thank you.
All right, that is the, so we said this was the Edison Concert Band. This was 1897, and this was an Edison wax cylinder.
Right.
Which is just like what it sounds like. It's a cylinder. It turns, and there's some kind of a stylus that comes in contact with the cylinder, kind of like a record. Something there's a groove, something rides in the groove, and
right.
That makes the sound.
Except it goes up and down. It's hill and dale. If you have a, you know, people who still have turntables out there, if you look at the needle on your LP or 45 or whatever it is, the needle's actually going laterally. It's vibrating back and forth. That's lateral technology. The cylinders go up and down. The grooves are hill and dale as the thing turns on a mandrel. And a feed screw takes the reproducer across.
So it sort of moves. It moves from left to right or right to left.
Left
it
left goes to right. That,
from
yeah,
left to right.
It goes from left to right, and there's a horn sticking out of it.
Yeah.
And your listeners can probably hear that horn quality. The band would have been performing into large horns that then made vibrations in a diaphragm and then etched their signal onto the soft wax. Mm. Now they would perform into a bank of horns, maybe a dozen or eight, and get that many copies out of one performance. And then they'd do this a number of times until everybody got tired. And then the studios could make copies from those cylinders. So if that last selection sounded a little brash, for instance, it's probably because it was copied either by a tube method. Those tend to sound kind of hollow. This one is a little more brash. This was probably pantographed. Which is
too complicated.
That's
to
a complicated.
Well, for people to get the image in their mind, I'm sure that people have seen old phonographs that have
the
big
horns, right? And
that's
just imagine
where the sound comes out of. So just imagine a much bigger one that the musicians would have to stand in front of and play into. So if the musicians would play into it. If there was a singer, they would sing into it.
Very loudly.
Very loudly. And the vibration. So there's no electricity involved.
None at all.
It's a completely physical method of doing this.
Yes.
You shout, you play into the big horn, and those vibrations eventually get translated into the little scratches on the cylinder. And then to play it back, you'd sort of do the same process backwards.
Exactly.
Because of the way it's recorded, you also can't stop and correct error. So there are cylinders that have somebody sneezing or moving a chair, and they just released it.
And also, I guess, the part of the reason that these things sound the way that they do is that there's a concept called dynamic range in music,
right.
Which essentially means the all of the range from the highest notes to the lowest notes. One of the things about this technology is that the highest notes and the lowest notes didn't make it.
That's right.
So all you're getting is kind of the in-between. That's also why it is why it sounds like kind of like music played over a telephone.
Exactly. Now, they could record more than they could play back. So if you listen to, you know, your old Victrola, a disc, or if you have a cylinder machine and you play it with the horn, you're going to get less bass and less treble than you could if you reproduced it electrically. So when we do our transfers, for instance, we use electric needles and methods, so we can get a little bit more bass.
So you're actually, so we, as a result of your technology, we can actually hear more than the people could when they were using the reproducing technology of the time.
Tiny bit more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a caller here, and I want to bring them into the conversation. Maybe I should also introduce our guest, Richard Martin, Megan Hennessy. They're the owners of Archaeophone Records, and they have put out a number of CDs. They have a website, by the way, if you'd like to go and find out about Archaeophone and look at their catalog.
It's at www.archeophone.com.
Okay, archeophone.com. And they are, as we've said, they're interested in preserving acoustic music recordings, things that these days would be extremely difficult to find, or even if you could find them, you might not be able to play them unless you had all the right hardware. And we do have somebody here with a call, somebody on a cell phone, so we'll get right to them. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You actually covered a couple of the things I wanted to ask about. As I was listening to it, I thought a couple of things. One was, it's sort of characteristic of really old recordings, that sort of tinniness, and I was thinking about wondering what the bandwidth of the technology was there, how much, you know, of the lows, because there is no bass in there. But as I was thinking about sound being vibrating air and being able to capture that vibration and translate that into something that you could reproduce, it was pretty amazing to me. That was really my first question. The other one was, I'm assuming that the Edison band had to do with Thomas Edison, the inventor of that, or is it more our local Edison High School band?
You're right. It's Thomas Edison's company, the National Phonograph Company, and his house orchestra, the Edison band. And they had several. It was the Edison Concert Band, the Edison Symphony Band, the Edison Brass Quartet, things like that. Your first question about frequency response on these, I can give you numbers that are probably generally agreed upon. People actually argue, you know, whether they can, you know, hear one extra hertz or not. But about 150 on the low scale, and up to, you know, 6,000 hertz on the high scale, or 5,000. The cylinders actually have harmonics that go higher than the discs. And I try to hold on to as many of those as possible when I produce these things.
The human ear hearing theoretically 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz in perfect hearing, that's pretty wild. But I was actually amazed at how good that sounds.
Yeah, there's a real beauty to the acoustic process once you get used to it. I mean, you know, if you can get over the prejudice we have towards whispering and microphones, there's a lot to enjoy there. There's a bracing freshness to it, and they sound very present. They sound like they're standing there next to you, hollering into a horn.
Yeah, and it's all mechanical. It's all just capturing that vibration and transferring it to a wax cylinder. I'm amazed how they figured out that would even work.
Right, and it was Edison who was at the vanguard of that. I mean, there are other people who made significant contributions, but in terms of cylinder technology, he's one of the first. The next selection that we're going to play actually is going to take us from the brown wax period, which we just heard, the early stuff where they were made, you know, one by one, to the mass production stage, where you won't have quite the brashness, because now instead of copying them from a master cylinder, they actually had a molded process where they could pour the wax in and produce them that way.
But literally those first ones, they had one horn for each cylinder, or did they have a mass of horns at all?
They
transferred
had
down to one cylinder.
They had a collection of horns they recorded onto, each of which recorded onto their own cylinder. And because the singer would be varying distances from them, the cylinders for the same take can have very different qualities. And they used to sell them in some cases in different ways, in terms of this one being better for listening to through earphones, and this one being better for a horn.
Thank you. Keep up. What's that?
I was going to just say one more thing about the performance. The orchestras would be sized down. I mean, you wouldn't have a full size orchestra. You'd have probably
you could only get so many people
right.
in front of the horn. So
exactly,
that's why you hear symphony sort of classical pieces, and they sound really stripped down. And that's because there weren't as many musicians as you would if you were having it on a concert stage in a full size.
Yeah, they wouldn't fit into the room, and it would overwhelm the apparatus. It just would be
right.
Nothing but mud.
Or they'd be too far away from it to really be picked up.
Yeah.
Compared to them. Well, keep up the good work.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for the call. And, of course, other calls are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, you suggested we might play something off of a different CD. It's a collection of recordings by a man named Billy Murray. Who was Billy Murray?
Billy Murray was the premier recording artist from about 1900 to 1925. He was just the biggest guy in the day. He recorded everything and recorded with just about everybody.
So he was the biggest star of his day.
Yes.
Yeah, he's really the biggest star prior to Bing Crosby.
Okay.
I mean, if you look at 1900 to 1950, it's Bing Crosby and Billy Murray. But because I would say 80% of his activity was acoustic records, and he did make it into the electric period, he just didn't have the same cachet anymore. Because I think he was in the acoustic era, people
He's just been forgotten.
He's just forgotten about because people said, well, that's old technology. It's like your 8-tracks. They threw them out and they said, why would we ever want to go revisit that scene?
Okay. This is a familiar familiar song, Meet Me in St. Louis, right?
And that's right.
When was this recorded?
1903, I think, released probably 04.
Okay. Let's hear that.
Meet Me in St. Louis, Louis, sung by Billy Murray at the Sun Records. When Louis came home to the flat, he hung up his coat and his hat. He gazed all around, but no wifey he found, so he said, where can Flossie be at? And note on the table he spied. He read it just once and he cried. It ran, Louis dear, it's too slow for me here, so I think I will go for a ride. Meet me in St. Louis, Louis, meet me at the fair. Don't tell me the lights are shining any place but there. We will dance the hoochie-coochie. I will be your tootsie-wootsie if you will meet me in St. Louis, Louis. Meet me at the fair. The dresses that hung in the hall were gone, she had taken them all. She took all his rings and the rest of his things, the picture he missed from the wall. What moving, the janitor said, your rent is paid 3 months ahead. What good is the flat, said poor Louis, read that, and the janitor smiled as he read. Meet me in St. Louis, Louis, meet me at the fair. Don't tell me the lights are shining any place but there. We will dance the hoochie-coochie. I will be your tootsie-wootsie if you will meet me in St. Louis, Louis. Meet me at the fair.
All right. That's the great Billy Murray, the great and sadly forgotten Billy Murray, from the collection Billy Murray Anthology. He was called the Denver Nightingale? Is that what?
That was a nickname that he was given early on. It became apparent within his first year or so that he was going to be a star, and all the companies employed him, and he made tons and tons of records. He's credited with having an extraordinary ability with the horn. He apparently nasalized certain syllables to make them stick into the wax a little better.
So there was a definite technique involved in singing into the horn so that you could get the best reproduction that you could get with that technique?
Yeah, so they say. And he certainly, you can always understand every word he says.
In fact, some of the people that became successful recording artists early on, it wasn't because of their voice, but the fact that they recorded very well.
Oh, so just something about them just happened to be suited to that particular to the limitations of the technology.
Right, and it's an extraordinary talent that can take something where you're essentially shouting and warm it up, personalize it, make it seem like you're not, which he's pretty good at doing.
We have another caller to talk with. This person is over in Terre Haute, Indiana, on our line 4. Let's go there. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
Or good morning in Illinois. I'm very interested in this. First of all, just as a side note, a friend in Nashville, Tennessee, has a pretty good set of recording devices, and we go to old-time music festivals, and he has people play in front of him, records them. He then cleans off the wax or reforms it and records again if you want another one. But I call about something else.
Mm-hmm.
My father, when he was in the Army, sent back a 78 RPM small shellac-based record, I believe. These were probably pretty cheap. Servicemen could go into a place and record and send it back to their family. Are those also, can they be copied with any quality so that you save the digital image of that?
Oh, sure. I think what you're talking about is what's called an instant disc, a lacquered record. And, those can be transferred the same as other discs.
Well, I will try to locate which of my sisters has this, then we will do something about maybe getting in touch with you.
Yeah, give us a call. Again, all the information is on the website at www.archaeophone.com, but our phone number is 217-469-7331, and we do that service as well as putting out the commercial CDs.
Well, I appreciate that. The ones that my friend made with the cylinders, he also transcribes those to CDs. I have several CDs of it. It sounds just like the old-time music, which sometimes isn't very good.
No.
So much noise in the background, but it's, back kind they used to record in the hills. And
so he's got, you said now, he's taking the old brown wax cylinders and shaving them down and re-recording on them?
Yes, some of them. And He says he buys some, too, that there are people who supply these now.
That's true. They do. There are people that supply the blanks. It's apparently a very guarded secret as to the to the formula they use, and it's a fairly labor-intensive process, too. Hmm.
But it's really interesting, because when about three people can be in front of the... he just has about a 2.5-foot diameter horn, and takes about... That's enough for three people to be there, and you can hear each of the instruments or the singers, but that's about it.
Hmm.
No more.
Well, that's an interesting. It's an interesting hobby. I wouldn't have thought that people were still just kind of for the fun of it using that old technology.
He does this. He goes around to old time music festivals where they're trying to preserve old traditions.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so then, do you want to be recorded on an old time wax cylinder? And you can take it home. You probably can't play it, but you can take it home.
Yeah. Or find somebody who'll make a conventional CD.
Yeah.
Before but people back in those days did use the blanks, the brown wax blanks, and do their own home recordings. Just like, you know, when people discovered cassettes and who wanted to record everything that everybody was doing, they were doing that with the brown wax cylinders.
Well, this is it's interesting. The guy's a record collector as well, but he old time records. But he's really got into this recording stuff, and I find it fascinating. Yeah. I thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455 toll free 800-222-9455. Our guests, Megan Hennessy and Richard Martin, are the owners of Archaeophone Records. They're interested in preserving old sound recordings, things that were done by the acoustic method. And they have a number of CDs, different kinds of music. And again, they also have a website. If you'd like to find out about them and what they have, you can just type Archaeophone Records into your website. That's sort of like archaeology.
That's right. Archaeology, except for sound. Uh-huh. And so it's Archeophone.
Okay. And as I say, other questions are certainly welcome. Now, I'm assuming that what happens when you are making a copy, what you do is you have to have either a turntable that will play 78s or something that will play wax cylinder, that you're taking that and putting it into a computer and using some kind of a program to try to take out scratches and clicks and remove things that are not the music so that what is there is the music and nothing else.
Yeah, that's correct. That we've got a number of different tools and programs we use to do that with.
They've gotten pretty sophisticated. Once you digitize the signal, the disc or the cylinder, there's any number of things you can do. And the first of which is eliminating as many pops and clicks as possible, crackle. And then after that, broadband noise, reduce that. And then I like to go in and fine-tune, edit, you know, get things that escape those processes, and then you need to, you know, equalize it again to be playable. And it's probably not okay simply to leave it just like that, because our modern playback devices, CD boomboxes and hi-fi stereos, can start ringing a little bit with the signal being so sharp there in the middle. It has to be adjusted a little bit in order not to blow your ears off.
Yeah. So it would have been interesting. I sort of only thought afterwards, but interesting to say to you, okay, bring something that was unretouched. We'll play that for people. So you can say, this is what it sounds like when they started.
Yeah.
And then we could say, okay, and this is what the end
results. Yeah, and at some point, I mean, you just have to stop. You can't fix everything. And one of the biggest problems, we kind of touched on it here a moment ago, is blasting. When the singer or the instruments are simply too loud for the device, the original device, to have captured it, it clips it. It goes into overdrive and it makes a loud, harsh noise. And that's one of the biggest problems we deal with, because a record that otherwise looks and sounds just terrific may have some of that, and it's pretty hard on the ears to hear that. And then we have to make a judgment call about, well, should we find another copy, you know, or is it really rare? You know, is it worth putting out even with these imperfections? And that's a tough decision.
And some cases, other copies have the same problem.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be in the master. Sometimes it happens through years of wear, where playing it back with steel needles has just blown out the walls of the disc, of the grooves. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk with someone else. We have another caller in Champaign. This would be line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. I'm going to turn off my radio. I have a question. I have gotten these, their old 78 records that they were my grandpa's, and I would very much like to make some copies, like on CD, and send them to my brothers and sisters. And, but I'm going to buy a new computer, and I'm wondering if I could buy this equipment and do this for myself, and how could I get the best quality if I did this myself?
Yeah, you can do it yourself. You just have to have, you know, a good phonograph, you know, and the right speed and needle and all that kind of thing. And
what kind of needle?
Just one that'll play 78s. You can't use a stereo LP stylus on 78s. It won't ruin them, but you won't get much sound because it's a very small needle. You need a bigger needle for 78s because the grooves are bigger than LPs and 45s.
Your turntable also needs to be able to play 78s too.
But once you
my
got
turntable does play 78s.
Okay.
I thought I was getting diamond tip needles for it.
Okay, you're probably in the right ballpark on that. And you know, give us a call and we can talk about some of the specifics. But the other thing is, you have to have some software to be able to digitize the signal and to put it onto a CD.
Okay.
I mean, if you're happy with the grooveware and the pops and clicks, or maybe you have, you know, 78s that are in terrific shape and you don't have to worry about that stuff very much.
Oh, but, no, they're definitely aged.
Ah.
It's just a nostalgic thing for me, that's all.
Yeah.
And so I want these 78s. I don't want anybody else.
Right. I got you. So you like them with the warts and all.
Well, they were my grandpa's, so
yeah.
That's what I want. Period.
Yeah. Well, yeah, again, you know, we'd be happy to give you some tips on that or help you or whatever. The thing is, it's pretty time intensive. I mean, getting, you know, because it's all in real time. You play it back in real time, and then whatever work you do on it is in real time. So, you know, it takes a surprisingly long amount of time to transfer, you know, a dozen or 20 sides, you know, and only fill up 60 minutes of a disc.
Okay. Well, I'm curious about it because I was thinking that maybe since I'm going to buy a computer anyway, if I knew what to buy, I could.
Well, make sure and get a CD burner in it.
So it's nothing special, huh?
No, it doesn't have to be. I mean, because you're just going to make a CDR and play it in your car or in your stereo or whatever, and all the this is actually a technological question too, David, so it brings us up to speed. When they first started putting out DVDs a few years ago, none of them played CDRs, but you know, in the most expensive models, $300-$400, you know, if you had a CDR, you couldn't play it.
Yeah,
but now they all do, and you can buy a DVD player for $30 and it'll play the CDRs, meaning compact disc recordable that you've made in your computer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, then I'll just wait and listen for the number you said to call later and get the details.
Yeah, it's 469-7331.
Thanks very much.
You bet.
Right. Thank you very much. And other questions again, welcome. 333-9455. Our number here for the show, same numbers always, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, what we've done here with the first couple of examples that we played was we're looking at how the technology started to get better and better. And you suggested that what we could do is move from the last recording that we played, that was Billy Murray. That was a cylinder.
That was a cylinder from the turn of 1903, 1904.
So what now we can do is we can play This Is a Disc.
Let's fast forward to 1916 and show what a quality disc sounds like from the teens. And this is a song that many of your listeners will know, Irving Berlin's I Love a Piano.
Okay, let's hear it.
I went wild when the band played. How I ran to the man when his hand swayed. Clarinets were my pets and a slide trombone I thought was simply divine. But today when they play I could hit them. Every bar is a jar to my system. But there's one musical instrument that I call mine. I love a piano, I love a piano. I love to hear somebody play on a piano, a grand piano. It simply carries me away. I know a fine way to treat a Steinway. I love to run my fingers o'er the keys, the ivories, and with the pedal. I love to meddle when Paderewski comes this way. I'm so delighted if I'm invited to hear that long-haired genius play. So you can keep your fiddle and your bow, give me a P-I-A-N-O. Oh, I love to sit right beside an upright or a high-toned baby grand. When a green tetrazine starts to wobble, I grow cold as an old piece of marble. I allude to the crude little party singer who don't know when to pause. At her best, I detest the soprano, but I run to the one at the piano. I always love the accompaniment, and that's because I love a piano, I love a piano. I love to hear somebody play on a piano, a grand piano. It simply carries me away. I know a fine way to treat a Steinway. I love to run my fingers o'er the keys, the ivories, and with the pedal. I love to meddle when Paderewski comes this way. I'm so delighted if I'm invited to hear that long-haired genius play. So you can keep your fiddle and your bow, give me a P-I-A-N-O. I love to sit right beside an upright or a high-toned baby grand.
All right, and that is once again the immortal Billy Murray, the Denver Nightingale, and that was a little bit later than the last recording we played. This was one that was made on a disc, a 78.
That's a 78 RPM disc RPM, from right. 1916.
And our guests are Richard Martin and Megan Hennessy, owners of Archaeophone Records in nearby St. Joseph, Illinois, and they're interested in preserving this kind of music. Go to their website. You can see what they've got. How now do you go about finding the original material? It must be not all that easy because you just can't go right out and get it. You must rely on other people like you who are interested in collecting and preserving this kind of stuff.
Initially, we started working with our own collection, but as we went on and did it longer, we started meeting people who had some of the very rare stuff. And we've got, for example, a couple of discs of popular songs from the 1890s, and we wouldn't have been able to do the second volume if it hadn't been for some great people we met who had stuff that was really old and never issued.
Sounds like maybe your headphones are up a little loud. We're getting a little feedback there, either that or maybe it was because you were kind of far away from the microphone.
Is this better?
Crank it on. That, yes, very nice. Okay. Thank you very much. And I think we're maybe getting another caller here lined up too. And we'd be very happy to, you know, if people have questions. I know our guests, Richard and Megan, will do their best to give you an answer. We have about 15 minutes left, or maybe more like 13 minutes left. Okay. And we got somebody here on cell phone, so we won't make them wait. We'll get to them. Line number two. Hello.
Hello. How
yes.
are you today?
Good.
I have a quick question, please. I didn't get in on the very beginning of this. My family has an Edison wind-up phonograph, quite old, with the platters that are over a quarter inch thick.
The diamond discs.
Yes. Do you have the machine for playing those if someone brought you the discs?
Yeah, we can do transfers of those. The thing about the Edison diamond discs, for people who don't know about them, they've probably seen them at the antique stores and flea markets. They're real thick and very heavy. Thomas Edison resisted the way of disc technology for as long as he possibly could. He thought that cylinders were far superior. And he's got a good claim there because in the aughts, 1907 or 8, cylinders had become very good and discs were not there yet. So when he did finally start making his own discs in 1912, the diamond discs were the result. And those are not played laterally like the other disc. Like we were saying earlier, the needle, the reproducer in the groove does not go sideways. It goes up and down. It's a Hill and Dale disc record, and you can't play those back on anything but a Hill and Dale machine. Now right. There is a way to do them using a regular turntable, and we know how to do that.
Okay, some of these discs are delaminating, and there are some that are particularly fond to the family that I might want to get recorded and cleaned up and so on.
Absolutely.
And so I'll give you a call. Thanks.
Please
right.
do.
Thanks for the call. Maybe Bye. Just one cautionary note we might give to people who are thinking about that. I don't want to discourage them from calling our guest. However, we would just like you to keep in mind that this is a very labor-intensive process. So when they tell you how much it would cost, you might be surprised. But, you know, if you want to find out, do give them a call.
Yeah, and if there's stuff that you can't get anywhere else, certainly it's, you know, I hope we're providing a service that people can profit by. But, you know, if you got a bunch of Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra 78s, those have been put out on CD. You might look yeah. to buy the CD. It's cheaper.
We did get a call from somebody, and maybe there are folks who do remember the time when you could go into an arcade or someplace like that and go into a little booth and sing a song or do whatever, and they would make a record. And for, you know, I don't know how much it cost, a quarter or something like that, not very much money, you could do that, and afterwards you could come out with mm-hmm. a record. And that there may be indeed some of these records around somewhere of people's grandparents or somebody like that they think, well, gee, wouldn't it be fun if we could actually play
yeah and
that?
Then they had them in the homes, and a lot of people recorded radio shows at home with their disc making machines.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left. We thought we'd play something else, and we're going to go to I'm going to talk to my Controium guy Henry Frame. We're going to play something off of this 1922 disc right there, and I think
it's selection number 16.
We'd like to go to Lovin' Sam, the Sheik of Alabama. This is track number 16. And who is this?
This is the Virginians with vocal by Miss Isabel Patricola.
All right, let's hear that. Romeo.
he doesn't do nothing else but put you up like a lovin' Sam. You could have your rates and ham in the finest kitchens down in Alabama. You'd make the highbrow babies cry for ya, like babies cry for Castoria. They all love lovin' Sam, the sheet of Alabama. Checkers neatly dressed, derby hat and a fancy vest, purple shirt, tie of red, everything for knocking them dead. Diamond pin, watch and chain, new kid gloves and a walking cane, yellow dog, made to strut, glass hot dog and nothing else but.
Again, that's Lovin' Sam, the Sheik of Alabama. And what year was that we're talking about?
1922. Hmm. You've just played that selection off our CD called 1922, An Angel's Voice I Hear. 1922 is the year WILL was founded.
Son of a gun.
It enabled us to show one of the things that we do. That's one of our most popular series called The Phonographic Yearbook, where we are putting out the big hits of each year of the acoustic era from the 1890s through the mid-20s. And they have a couple dozen songs and these lavishly illustrated color booklets. It's a real bonus. And that's one angle we take on this material. We're trying to take all this enormous amount of material and put it out in sensible ways. And that's one series that's very popular. But some people who like compilations like that, and they want to know what was a big hit in a given year, there are other people who only like to have a particular performer. So we're doing the things like the Billy Murray Anthology on those.
So how many discs are there in your catalog at the moment?
There are 19 right now with several more on the way.
Okay, very good. We have a caller here in Urbana. Let's talk with them. Line number two. Hello.
Where do we order that catalog?
You can call us at 469-7331 later in the day, or go to the web at www.archeophone.com. And the spelling is ArchEophone.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I would expect that there would be a relatively limited audience for this kind of music for a variety of reasons, but that there would be a lot of people who would find it fun and fascinating to hear these recordings because they were popular performers and songs at the time, because performance styles were different, and so you could hear what the music was like. And just because some of them, for example, like the man we talked about, Billy Murray, who was a huge star in his day, and after the acoustic era, the man was just forgotten.
That's right.
It is preserving history. But I'm sure that there are some people who say, well, who wants to listen to scratchy old records like that anyway?
There's a bigger audience for it than you might imagine. People who are interested in history, some people who are, you know, researching a given project and want to know what was the culture of a given time, people whose parents, you know, sang them those songs when they were growing up, people who have the records in their closet. But the problem that we have, and it's a little frustrating, is that it is a niche market, certainly. And when you consider that niche covers 35 years, it's not monolithic. I mean, there's a lot of different stuff, and some of it will appeal to that member, the members of that niche market, and some things won't. So that's where it's tough, is trying to get everybody on board for the various things that we're trying to do. And of course, we've gotten lucky. People seem to trust our judgment, but we hope that they like what we're putting out. We're working on a 2-CD set right now that's going to be out in the spring of The Great War, where it's going to have, I don't know, 56 tracks, including really rare excerpts from a record with Woodrow Wilson on it, and other hit songs of the war, and other songs that show the different kinds of political things that were going on in the country at that time.
Had you thought about doing much in the way of spoken word, or you just say your territory is music and that's what you're going to do?
We have one spoken word disc, and we're going to be working on other artists who, there's one artist we're working on in particular, Cal Stewart, who he's one of our upcoming projects, who did a spoken word character, and he was almost exclusively spoken word.
Uncle Josh. People. He was a contemporary of Mark Twain's, a good friend of Mark Twain's.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He did rural humor.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time. If you're interested in finding out what Archaeophone is all about, you can, and you have access to the internet, you can go to their website, archaeophone.com, and you can see some of what's in their catalog. And you can actually, even if you have the right stuff on your computer, you can hear some examples of some of their current stuff.
That's their samples up there. We are in some of the bigger stores in the bigger cities, Tower, Best Buy, Porter's, and some of these, but not necessarily locally. And anybody who's interested in getting the stuff in the store, we'd encourage you to tell the people at the stores, including Pages, that you'd like them to carry our stuff and support local business.
All right. Well, Richard Martin, Megan Hennessy of Archaeophone Records in St. Joseph, Illinois, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.